Everybody kind of has a strong sense that they're being shafted through the whole financial system, but they don't quite understand how and why.
He said, "You'll be joining us at a very exciting time. We are creating a huge environmental problem that will frighten people into wanting a world government run by us." So that is when, if you like, I suddenly realized that we were being run by other entities above our elected representatives.
It's all right underneath our noses. This big con trick and fraud is right there underneath our noses. But it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all disguised by smoke and mirrors.
None of them will accept the basic truth, and that is everything is in private, unelected, unaccountable hands of people who meet in complete secrecy. Every aspect of the financial world is under the guise of criminals.
Hello everyone, you've just heard the voices of today's guests, Daniel Thompson-Mills and Justin Walker. Daniel is a returning guest to the show and has previously appeared speaking about his books on COVID and climate change. Today he's joined by Justin to speak about a book they co-authored, The Truth of How Money is Created and the Financial System, How a Small Number of People Siphon Off the Vast Majority of the World's Wealth for Themselves and How to Change This. As it's Justin's first time on the show, I started out by asking him to tell his very interesting story of how he came to have a radical outlook on the world.
I think I was fairly normal when I was born. And I think the first 20 odd years, I was again fairly normal. But something happened at the age of 16, which was to give me an idea of what was to come. My uncle was a gentleman by the name of Lord Pilkington, Lord Harry Pilkington, or Lord Pilkington of St. Helens, Pilkington's Glass. Uncle by marriage, an absolutely delightful individual, very generous, very funny, very eccentric. And when he died in 1983, quite literally, virtually the whole town of St. Helens turned out on a cold, snowy day. He was a lovely man. And he went to the very first Bilderberg group meeting in 1954, something I didn't know until well after his death. And he also was a director of the Bank of England for 17 years, from 1955 to 1972. And it was actually in 1972, I was going back to school to do my O levels, and we were on the train, and we're talking about general things. And he suddenly said, "Justin, what are you doing when you leave school?" So I said, "Well, I'm hoping to go into the army and short service commission, and then I'll probably go into the family business." He said, "Well, I'm going to give you two bits of advice to take through life, two bits of advice." He said, "First of all, never believe anything you see in the press, because we control it. And secondly, never, ever believe a politician when they say they can do something. They can't unless we say they can." Now, to a 16-year-old, that went straight across my head. But I remember thinking, "Oh, well, here's something to do with banking and business and stuff, City of London." I didn't know too much about it, but I just remember the conversation perfectly. Well, fast forward then I was intrigued by Jacques Cousteau. I'm names dropping now, I do apologize, but I was intrigued by Jacques Cousteau and his underwater films. And of course, this is all before DVDs and videos and God knows what else. You literally did see it on television, and that was it. And he started to call people to come forward to take part in political conservation, to actually start worrying about the planet, but to call the politicians to account. And I thought that sounded like a jolly good idea. And then I heard about the Ecology Party, and this is 1978. And so I joined it, and I met the likes of Jonathan Porritt and Teddy Goldsmith at the Ecologist magazine and all sorts of people. And I really got into it. I thought, this is brilliant. And my uncle was very encouraging. He said, "No, you must do this. This is all brilliant stuff." When the World Conservation Strategy came out in 1980, which I now know is a completely globalist thing that they did, but it was done by the Worldwide Fund for Nature, WWF, and the IUCN, and the United Nations Environment Programme. And he gave me all the stuff that he'd been sent as one of the, ex-Bilderberg and what have you. And I was actually taken by this. And then I read a book called 100 Pages for the Future, and it was by a gentleman called Aurelio Pecce. And my uncle said, oh, right, you've met, you. I know Aurelio. Oh, I know, because he was a fellow Bilderberger, both been to Bilderberg. And anyway, I wrote to Aurelio Pecce. My uncle said, write to him. And of course, this is before emails, this is snail mails, you know. And a few weeks later, I got a reply personally from Aurelio Pecce saying, I'm coming to London, this is 1982. I'll be happy to have lunch with you, meet with you, and then come down to London and meet up. And I did. And I met both Aurelio Pecce and Thor Heyerdahl, the Kon-Tiki expedition explorer. And we had lunch. And unknown to me, my uncle and Aurelio had obviously had a chat before, because he offered me a job. He said, would you like to come and work for the Club of Rome? In Rome as one of my political researchers. Now, I was completely taken aback by this. I had a commission in the Territorial Army. I worked for my father in the family business. I had a new girlfriend. I wasn't sure what to think. So I said, well, can I think about it? He said, well, think about this. He said, you'll be joining us at a very exciting time. We are creating a huge environmental problem that will frighten people into wanting a world government run by us. And of course, that was man-made global warming. So that was my introduction to that. But it wasn't until I met, because I was on Green Party Council, when I came across a gentleman called David Icke. I wonder what he's done. And dear old David and I became good friends because we had a mutual love of steam engines and stuff. And so that is when, if you like, I suddenly realized that we were being run by other entities, that other, you know, above our elected representatives, there are others pulling strings. And I started to think this is more to do with the City of London. So I started to research money creation as one of many different aspects to how we were being controlled. And I came across a very nice lady called Ellen Brown, E-L-L-E-N, Ellen Brown, who was very skeptical about the current banking arrangements, said everything was in private hands and unelected, unaccountable, etc. And she cited Abraham Lincoln's greenback dollar as a better way of creating money. And I looked at that and I thought, this is during the American Civil War. And the greenback dollar was debt-free, interest-free money that was based on he described it as the integrity of the American government, which I mean, if you go by the integrity of our government today, you wouldn't be able to buy a single meal. You know, I mean, it was a weird thing. But nonetheless, what they meant was on the credit of the nation, because Abraham Lincoln had tried to get loans from the City of London to fight the American Civil War, but he was told it would be 25-30% interest. And he realized he was putting a debt noose around the American economy. So that's when, as I said, he talked to one of his friends and he said, why don't you just get the government to create its own money, debt-free? So they did. So I was intrigued by that. So I wrote an article for the UK column. In those days, the UK column was a newspaper and not the programme it is now. And I wrote it, and it was entitled, Can't We Have a Greenback Pound? So I wrote that, didn't think any more of it. And until about 4 months later, my phone went. At home, my wife was in the kitchen. My daughter was in the room doing her homework, and so I answered the phone, and there was a very posh voice said, "Oh, hello, is that Justin Walker?" So I jokingly replied, "Well, it might be." He said, "Well, let me put your mind at rest. Are you the nephew of the late Lord Pilkington?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Marvellous." He said, "Marvellous. I'm ringing on behalf of my father, who's not long for this world, and he was a director of the Bank of England with your uncle." I said, "Right." "And he happens to have read your article in the UK column." "Oh." Now, I don't know how he got my number or anything, but they obviously knew what they were doing. And he said, I'm giving you the name. And he said, "I want to give you the name Bradbury." And by this time, I was panicking because there was no paper, no pen by the phone. My laptop was closed. So I said, "What was that, Brad?" So I breathed on the window and wrote Bradbury. He said, "Now you're not going to be able to trace our number and you won't be able to talk to us again. But if you research the Bradbury, you will find a solution to all of Britain's economic woes." I went, "Oh, right, okay." He said, "Now I'm sorry we can't talk again or anything. You won't be able to trace this call. Nice talking to you. Goodbye." Now I can safely say I was rather dazed by that. I always described it as my Richard Hannay, 39 Steps, John Buchan and all that. What the hell was that? So I eventually got my laptop open and started looking through. And the first one I came up with, when I fed Bradbury into the search engine, and this is 2012, by the way, this is September 2012. And the first individual I came up was Julia Bradbury. And I thought, well, how is she going to save the British economy? And I thought, that's not right. And then I came across the author of The Martian Chronicles. I thought, that's not going to do me much good either. And by this time, I was getting a bit desperate. I was going through, and I suddenly came across somebody selling stamps and currency, notes, old notes and stuff. And suddenly my eye caught Bradbury Pound. What the hell's that? And that's when I came across the Bradbury Pound. Then I fed Bradbury Pound in, and eventually I got a gentleman called Thomas Johnston, who was an MP, a Labour MP in the 1930s. A very good MP. He did an awful lot of good for Scotland. He was the father of the Scottish hydroelectric scheme, and he was a politician that very few people had anything bad to say about him. Anyway, upshot was, I looked into this chap, Thomas Johnston, and he wrote a book in 1933, something like that, and it was called The Financiers and the Nation. And this gave the whole story of the Bradbury Pound. Do you want me to carry on with that?
I'll just pause you there for a moment because I think that we're
Okay.
going to transition to talking about the Bradbury Pound now. So I'd like to bring Daniel in a second, just get a sort of overview of his involvement in this. Just before I do that, just to pick up, it's very interesting. And I'm curious, did you actually go and work for the Club of Rome?
No,
Because
no,
what I
no.
found interesting was the overt nature in which I kind of expect that people involved in these things are in some ways deluding themselves, and they think that they're saving the environment, and but they really have a desire for control that's manifest through that. It's very interesting how overtly you were told we are creating a false environmental
Yeah,
problem.
totally, because he viewed me as a potential useful idiot who wasn't going to question anything. I was an ecologist, in the sense political ecologist. My uncle was a uncle by marriage, but nonetheless my uncle. He thought I was going to be groomed. I was the perfect one to be groomed. So
Do you
that's
conceive of men like this and men like your uncle as perceiving that they are doing the right thing for the world in some moral sense, that the world
Well,
needs
I
managers?
will tell you an interesting conversation he had with my father one Christmas at Windle Hall, which was his ancient seat, we might call it. And one Christmas, and I was listening in. I think I was about 22, 23 at the time. And he was talking to my father, and he said, "Raymond," he said, "you do realize that when you invest in a country, you invest millions, and of course, in those days, that figure would be billions today." He said, "When you invest on behalf of your shareholders, a large amount of money into a country, you've got to be able to make sure that that country's government is stable and they're not going to suddenly nationalize it or take, do anything that would damage your investment." So he said, "It's very important that you find ways of controlling governments." And that was his viewpoint. So it was from a commercial viewpoint, from what he told my father.
See, I can see that. And we all know the CIA went around the world during the Cold War playing whack-a-mole with any socialist government that came along for exactly that reason, for nationalization. And they kind of took that role on from MI6. So you have like Mossadegh in Iran, and then you have nationalizing the oil, and then he's replaced and the Shah's brought in. And that carries on as a pattern. And I can see how the men doing this, like the Dulles brothers and so on, thought that they were just, this is the way the world should be managed for the ultimate good, right? But when you have someone overtly saying, well, essentially almost cartoonishly, we're going to take over the world through creating an environmental scare, it sort of suggests a certain contempt for the populace, a certain contempt for the plebs, the proles, who need to be given scary stories. But do you think that these people see themselves as like just good managers, essentially, and that they are the ones that they need to keep the populace under control so that the thing can be managed properly, and you're not going to have like lunatics coming along and socializing industries and that kind of thing? Is that the sense you got?
I suppose the word meritocracy springs to mind. We're talking basically people who want a new feudal system. They believe they have a divine right to decide our futures. And of course, if you take it deeper and you start to look at the Zionists and many others who believe that they have a certain right, God-given right even, to be in charge, who knows? We're still trying to discover who is, really ultimately at the top of the pyramid. Mm. We have a good idea. Certain dynastic banking families are often mentioned and various others. But I'm being reliably informed by my latest research that they're the middle order batting. And you've got a lot further to go to find out who's ultimately pulling all the strings. And of course, you may start to go into the realms where David Icke has gone, into different frequencies and dimensions, and Lord only knows what. Fascinating stuff. All the good matrix, So I keep an open mind on everything.
Right.
But I can just say how I was nudged into the position I was today, just by family involvement. But I have to emphasize again, my uncle was a delightful individual. Mm. He was certainly not a shapeshifter who was going around attending sacrifices and doing anything else. I hope not anyway. I don't think he was. No, he was a lovely man. So I always have a very, very happy memory of him.
Okay. Daniel, at this point, let's bring you in. Now, you've been on the show before and really spoken a lot about your journey, both with COVID and with this conversion around global warming and coming to re-see that. So I'd obviously point people to those interviews because they are fascinating, both for the technical detail and also on how an example of someone who profoundly changes their mind around a core ideology. But as we're going to talk about the Bradbury Pound itself in a moment and currency, could you maybe give sort of an overview of your journey, more specifically of that, of when you're going through these things and you're deconstructing what you thought you knew about the world? And I suppose at some point you have to come to finance, you have to come to the banking system. So can you maybe just give an overview of that, please, and anything else you have to comment on so far?
Yes, thank you, Richard. Well, essentially, having seen the absolute fallacy of the germ theory of disease and how it's not been scientifically proven and how it's put forward very much for the interests of the pharmaceutical industry. And again, to keep us all in fear, this bogeyman, so to speak, of the virus or the pathogens out to get us, we're at the mercy of all these things. It's a sort of always to do with being a victim, being in a war situation, whether to do with health or whatever. So seeing through that and realizing that, no, actually, the terrain model of looking at the body and health and how we're an ecosystem is that's the real deal. And that's when it gets very exciting. And then moving on to climate change. And as you say, going through a whole kind of journey of unraveling my conditioning around that, and realizing we're all being hoodwinked massively for nefarious reasons. And it's not to say by any manner of means that there isn't a huge environmental crisis, because there is, which we need to address massively. But this whole focus on man-made global warming is a complete distraction and takes all our energy away from real positive solutions. Now, I've been doing lots of presentations and getting books and my work on this out into the world, and I've had lots of positive feedback, lots of people interested. But it's generally people, virtually always, who are people already who've sort of had have taken an open mind of being curious and had what generally gets called some sort of awakening experience through their own, perhaps very challenging things that have happened in their life, like injuries from the things that get injected into us, but often just kind of a big penny drop, or having friends who've been able to help them to realize a bit more of what the real state of the world is, and who's, as I say, Justin says, who's pulling the strings and why and how. Anyway, so within all of that, I've also, I ultimately, what my real big passion is, being a community activist, working on a local level. And so, yeah, it's been great to sort of do podcasts like this and go around the country and do presentations, and I think that's all valuable work. But ultimately, I've tried to sort of engage with my local community on these topics. Now, what I've found is that when it comes to the germ theory, people are so entrenched in that, and that mindset and that conditioning, it's so difficult for people, even if they're relatively open-minded, I've found, to really, what's the word, dedicate themselves like I did to really delving deep and sort of unraveling the whole thing. Because the germ theory, it kind of makes sense, and people just see the world in that way. And it's so I've had great difficulty really in kind of breaking through, if you like. What I'm doing here is just making an invitation, making an offering to people. I'm not saying I'm the all-seeing, all-knowing, but it seems that people aren't even willing, very much at least, to veer from the germ theory perspective. And then when it comes to climate change, well, I know a lot of committed environmentalists around here, and people who are doing good work, and so on. But virtually all of them, I mean, not completely, but virtually all of them are very wedded to the man-made climate change narrative. And really, the way I see it is that their passion for the environment and love for the Mother Earth, and such a strong feeling of emotional response to how that, to the abuse that goes on of our environment, of our, Mother Earth, which is, of course, what gives everything life, and what our, where our life comes from as well. And seeing through our lifetimes the continual degradation of all of that, it's very emotional experience, and it and so on. So, and then, of course, people who are actually doing something about that, prepared to kind of get out there, have been, sort of all siphoned off into the Extinction Rebellion type groups, and now Just Stop Oil, who are really just taking all of their energy down a cul-de-sac, is the way I see it, at least. So that passion for Mother Earth is so enmeshed with the climate change story, and I've tried to, encourage a little chink of light between those two things, at least, so that, or at least encourage people to listen to what I have to say. You may completely disagree with me, that's fine, but it just seems to be really impossible to get anybody to even consider something different from what they're being fed through the media and so on those topics. So I've realized over time that the money system and people's interest in that is quite different, that everybody kind of has a strong sense that they're being shafted through the whole financial system. But they don't quite understand how and why. Of course, it's all right underneath our noses. This big con trick and fraud is right there underneath our noses, but it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all disguised by smoke and mirrors. So, for example, we're given this impression, but it's never explicitly said, that the Bank of England is somehow part of the state, or some sort of hived off part of central government that has some, supposedly for good reasons, independence from the government, but the Prime Minister appoints the governor of the Bank of England and all this sort of thing. As it gives the impression that the Bank of England is there to serve the interests of the people. Well, No, the Bank of England is a private institution. It's there to serve the interests of its shareholders. The shareholders are private. We don't know who they are. It was created by Royal Charter in 1694, etc., etc. And they make money out of thin air and they loan it to the government and so on. And I feel that the money system is the way in because people are much more curious. They're much more interested or willing to hear what I have to say and what similar people to me have to say about it. And the other good thing is the core of it, the nub of it, is explainable really easily in a few minutes. And what you can say, and what I've been saying actually, to kind of just underline this is, the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve, but let's focus on the Bank of England. This is a misnomer for deliberate reasons. Actually, what the Bank of England is, giving one name in particular, it's the Bank of the Rothschilds UK branch. And the Federal Reserve is the Bank of the Rothschilds US branch. And then as soon as you kind of hear that, it starts to make more sense to people about what's going on in the banking world. So for a while, I really felt I wanted to bring into my work a book on the financial system and so on, and solutions to that, the debt-based system. And in the meantime, I'd got to know Justin and his work. And that was particularly because my work on climate change had made a contact between us. And then Justin gave me a document he'd written, which included the story of the Bradbury Pound and really just sending out the basis of the debt-based financial system. And I've felt that Justin had done a lot of research on this topic. And so I approached him and said, well, how about we collaborate on a book where I essentially take your work and I adapt it a little bit or, edit it basically and then add some other stuff around it to make it a book where we're covering a lot of the history of the financial and banking system, and in particular the Bradbury Pound, which hasn't been at all referenced really in any other alternative, you could say, books on the money system that I'm aware of at least. And Justin, you really know it as better than anybody.
Okay, let's start to talk about that. Well,
Yes.
do, gentlemen. I think I can summarize everything I know about this subject in about a minute. So I'll do that, and then you can tell me all about the Bradbury Pound and your research on it. So, as I said before we started recording, this is the interview that I've gone into perhaps with the most reluctance, because I say reluctance because I usually try and be quite prepared and understand at least an overview off the topic before I interview people, so I feel I can ask a decent question. And with this subject of the financial system, I always feel it's just not one for me. Like when I've covered things like the United States in the First World War, and obviously that brings in the Federal Reserve System, I've always just give it two lines and say, well, I think the Austrian free market economists are about right. So if you want an opinion, go and look at that. And the very simple model I have to understand central banking is just by analogy, if a baker wanted to acquire a pair of shoes and the cobbler would charge him five loaves of bread, consume one loaf a day for 5 days, and at the end you've got a pair of shoes. Now, if the baker was to put three loaves of bread in a bank account, but the bank said they wrote notes for five loaves, and then handed those notes to the cobbler, that would be fine on days one, two, and three, and then the whole thing will come crashing down on day four. So you'd have a boom and a bust, the way we see in the banking system. And this creation of artificial money, which is not backed by resources, causes that problem in society. And then I suppose people can ride that wave, know it's coming, to profit themselves. And that, gentlemen, is everything I know about it. So I'm in no position to ask penetrating questions. So hopefully that will work as an interview and its way to go in. Now, why don't you tell me, in however way you want to divide it up, Justin and Daniel, into what the problem is and what the solution is in the form of this Bradbury Pound.
Okay, well, maybe if I just run through how the Bradbury Pound was used in 1914 and why it was used. Essentially, as we all know, August the 3rd, August the 4th was the declaration of Britain getting involved in the First World War. And we were on the gold standard in those days, which basically meant all the notes put out by the Bank of England were supposedly backed by the amount of gold they had in their vaults. But because they were practicing fractional reserve banking, they'd put out many times more notes than they had actual gold to cover it. And in fact, I think they had around 9 million pounds worth of gold in the vaults. But before everyone says, that's not much, you must understand that a pound today, sorry, a pound then is worth 160 something pounds today. I don't know the exact figure because of inflation, but we're talking a lot of money. So there was quite a lot of gold in the vaults of the Bank of England. However, people could see that paper money could collapse well, should we say, with the shenanigans of the First World War, you don't know what's going to happen. So people suddenly thought, I want to get my hands on gold because on the notes it says, I promise to pay the bearer the sum of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So people were queuing outside the Bank of England and the high street banks with their notes. And in those days, there were £5 notes. So as I said, that's a lot of money in those days. And people wanting basically come away with gold sovereigns and half sovereigns in their hand. And well, they just didn't have the gold, and there was going to be a run on the banks. So the governor of the Bank of England at the time, with some minions from the City of London, went running round to David Lloyd George, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer before he became Prime Minister later on in the First World War, and said, look, old boy, there's going to be a run on the banks, a complete collapse of the City of London, just at the time when we're mobilizing for the First World War. This isn't going to be very good. And this, by the way, is a genuine example of the banks wrong-footing themselves, as opposed to usually when there's a collapse, boom, bust, it's all contrived and they know exactly what they're doing. In this particular case, they didn't. And they basically found themselves in a dicky situation. So David Lloyd George got a bill through Parliament in 2 days, the Currency Notes Act, authorizing the Treasury to create debt-free and interest-free money that was based firmly on the wealth and labour potential, the creativity of the country, the credit of the country. And the first batch of notes were produced on stamp paper because that was the only paper they could have immediately at hand. Because bear in mind that all the banks were closed. There was a bank holiday on the Monday, August the 4th, I think it was, a declaration of the war. But then they kept the banks closed, so they had the chance to print the money, to authorize it through Parliament, first of all, and then to print the money. And the first batch of notes were available on printed on one side only. They were called Bradbury's or Bradbury pounds because the gentleman who had signed the notes was Sir John Bradbury, who was the first Secretary to the Treasury. And anyway, so when the banks reopened, people were coming in with their Bank of England notes and saying, well, can we have gold? And they said, well, we can't have gold, but you can have these. And it was explained to them, this was money based on the credit of a nation. And they accepted these notes willingly. So everyone was very happy. Everyone went away with these notes and, people were using them to buy things and whatever. So everything was fine, except for the bankers, because suddenly they realized that there was a danger that the Treasury might fight the entire war using debt-free, interest-free money, money that was based on the wealth of a nation. So they slipped round to see David Lloyd George again and said, hang on, old boy, you've saved our bacon. That's very nice of you. Thank you very much. But could you now perhaps resort to the usual system of creating bonds and we buy the bonds, IOUs, and at 3%, 3.5%, whatever it is. And David Lloyd caved in, and I'm still fascinated to know why he caved in. I've got some suspicions, but we'll leave them at that at the moment. But anyway, he caved into their wishes. So the Bradbury pound was not taken down. It wasn't stopped immediately. In fact, the last Bradbury pound, I think from memory, came out in around about 1926. No, they phased the amount of money being based on the wealth of the nation. They phased most they faced quite a lot of that out, and went back to creating bonds for the City of London to buy. And this meant that at the end of the First World War, the national debt, which, by the way, is a completely unlawful body, you know, it can be annulled because it is totally unlawful, that's another story. The national debt, which was standing at 650 million in 1914, by the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, was 7,500 million. So effectively, the bankers had made the killing out of the killing. And that was the story of the Bradbury pound in the First World War. And incidentally, the cash you have in your pockets, the loose change, is actually created on the same principle that they created those notes, M naught. And they still practice that today. M naught at something like 2.3% or something. All the coins we have, the 2 pound coins, the 1 pound, the 50 pence, 20 pence, 10 pence, 5 pence, 2p, 1p, etc. All those coins are produced using the same fiscal process that we created the Bradbury pounds. And what we're saying is, we don't have to be involved with the City of London. We do not have to be involved with the Bank of England. We could carry on creating that money as we did in 1914. And the one institution that we haven't mentioned, which wasn't created until 1930, which is the hub of the entire central banking system of the world, and which oversees the debt noose that is currently the world is in. And this is the Bank for International Settlements, an organization that hardly anyone has heard of. And I actually approached 25 MPs from 2012 until today. I've talked personally to 25 MPs. And when I say hello to them, the first question I then ask them is, what can you tell me about the Bank for International Settlements? And they can tell me absolutely nothing. And yet this is the bank. They have 63 member banks, including the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, Bank of Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They've got 63 central banks who are direct members, and every central bank in the world is influenced by the Bank for International Settlements. It has given itself diplomatic immunity. It has meetings of the top governors, usually about 12 or 13 of them, and they meet in absolute secrecy every 5 to 6 weeks at Basel in Switzerland, where they have these two-day meetings. The entire organization, as I said, total secrecy, and effectively it means the entire financial system of the world and how much money is allowed to be created is decided by unelected, unaccountable people who meet in absolute secrecy. These are private individuals. Money creation and money supply is not in the hands of the people. And this organization was started by Montagu Norman, who was the governor of the Bank of England after the First World War in 1930. And his co-conspirator was Helmut Schacht, who went on to become Hitler's finance minister. And the Bank for International Settlements was created under the cover story of looking after German war reparations after the First World War. But in point of fact, it was to become the central bank of all central banks. It was not being controlled by the governors of all these banks. It's controlled by the dynastic families. So, you know, you're talking Rothschild, Rockefellers, and all the rest of them. There's about 7 or 8 key banking Warburgs. They're key banking families. They pull the strings. And the chap called Professor Carol Quigley blew the whistle on this in about 1964 in his book. I'm trying to remember what it's called, Tragedy, I hope. I can't remember the name of the book. Anyway, he blew the whistle on this. And he, as a result, he was allowed to attend some of the secretive meetings, and he was an insider, and he decided it was just too important, so he blew the whistle on this. But effectively, they've done a great job in covering their tracks. Very few people know about the Bank for International Settlements, because that is the driving force for all the problems we have in the global economy today.
Can I just come back? Thank you, Justin. Can I just come back quickly a little bit more on the Bradbury Pound as I understand it, and particularly the effects that it had on the British people and the British economy, which is essentially that the government wisely put enough currency in the system to facilitate trade. But not too much that it created inflation, or not too little that trade was hampered. So, in such a situation where you're creating sovereign money and you're getting it out there into the economy, if you're able to do that and find the right, sweet spot, then that led on, as it did with the Bradbury Pound, to create zero inflation and full employment. So there was it created a huge amount of prosperity, and my understanding is that the Bradbury pounds were extremely popular, just as the greenback dollars had been in America, and they the greenback dollars, I understand, there were still some in circulation as late as the 1990s, believe it or not, and people were very reluctant to let go of the greenback dollar. So that's my sense of it, I think. And so it's an example of actually, if you get off the debt-based system and take the sovereign money approach, then it's beneficial for the people in the economy, rather than all that wealth being siphoned off to the private bankers for their personal gain.
How would you contrast this to a commodity-based money system like a gold-backed currency, or essentially notes representing gold and being a realistic representation? So they're not, you're not shaving off bits of the gold, a sort of honest gold standard system. Because the Bradbury Pound seems to be something quite different to that. Like I'm not clear on the backing. It seems sort of vague, like the wealth of the nation being, or the creativity of the nation being the backing. Would you not favour a gold standard, or favour something like the Bradbury Pound?
A gold standard couldn't work. Where are you going to find all that gold from? It's a finite resource. There's not that much of it in the world, and those who have got it will love a country to go on a gold-backed coin, gold-backed currency, because quite simply the price would soar. Where are you going to find the gold? We sold off about a third or half of our gold under Gordon Brown. There isn't the gold, enough gold in the world to become a global base again. So it's just not going to happen. But when you ask, well, what is the Bradbury Pound based on? Well, the Office of National Statistics have said the combined totals of labour and our assets, what we're worth, is around about £31 trillion. I say round about because I haven't seen the up-to-date figures. Their last set of figures was just before COVID. But we are probably worth in the region of 30-something trillion pounds. So, what you do is that's no word, that's something solid. That is what our country's worth. So you put a fraction, just a mere fraction of that, and you create the money as and when, and it is for your infrastructure projects and it's for your services. So in other words, it's for the running, the good governance of your country. And you don't go mad with it, obviously, otherwise you will trigger inflation and God knows. And by the way, talking about inflation, hyperinflation, they always quote the Weimar Republic in 1930. No, oh, terrible, terrible. This is the Weimar Republic, the debt there, the hyperinflation, was not triggered by the government of the Weimar Republic, but by the private central bank at the time, plus the people on Wall Street and the City of London. So again, going back to my friend Ellen Brown, she did a very good article on exposing the real causes for the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the hyperinflation that went there. And of course, that's always blamed on creating money, but they don't say who is creating the money, the government. I liken it to a canal. A canal, you have to have stable water level. And on that stable water level, you have all your barges going up and down. And that's the economy. Economy is flourishing. Everyone's happy. It's stable. There are, you haven't got private financial markets mucking around buying money, buying currency and selling and all the rest of it. It's just boring and stable, lovely and stable, and like a canal. And of course, when you have too much rain, i.e., more money coming in, They have sluices to take away the excess rainfall, so you keep the nice level. And maybe it's a very crude analogy, that, but that's what we're talking about. We're talking about stability. So people have enough money to do business for the country and for the people. So no one is left behind. And it's debt-free, interest-free money. And as I said, the national debt could be written off in a trance, because the entire thing has been brought about with mens rea, malice aforethought, and under our common law constitution, we only require a jury to say it's all been arrived at by unlawful means, therefore it can be annulled. So I never get worried about the national debt. It, to me, it doesn't exist, because it's entirely the work of dishonest people, criminals. So it can be annulled. Some people wouldn't agree with me on that. Well, that's their privilege. But I'm sorry, as far as I'm concerned, everything since 1694, when the Bank of England was created, has been a criminal entity, an enterprise. So as far as I'm concerned, the national debt does not exist. And basically, where the Bradbury comes in, it's stable, and we don't get it. It's a currency that doesn't involve itself with the financial markets. All those financial markets. I mean, I had a whistleblower. I don't know his name, but he claimed he was a distant relative of Vincent Vickers. And Vincent Vickers was a stalwart of the City of London. And he was actually a director of the Bank of England during the First World War. And he saw the Bradbury rescue the economy. And since then, he was a champion of sovereign money. And anyway, this relative rang up, claiming he was a relative. I don't know his name, but he just said, you will not have any trouble with anybody in the financial world, any economists. And he actually said the Austrian school and others. He said, you know, the Keynesian school, the Austrian school, the school for new economics. He said, quite simply, none of them will accept the basic truth, and that is everything is in private, unelected, unaccountable hands of people who meet in complete secrecy. Every aspect of the financial world is under the guise of criminals. And he said, that's the first thing. And it doesn't matter who the economists are, London School of Economics, all these people, they cannot accept that one essential fact, that we, the people, have no say in money creation and money supply. So, you know, it's so obvious, it's so blatant. And so, you know, to me, this is the only way forward. And all these people who talk about cryptocurrencies and all these things, I was told by an insider, and bluntly, that the entire crypto system will be taken down as and when the CBDC, central bank digital currencies, kick off. And that the elite, the global elite, will just completely take down any cryptocurrency. So this is the only way of creating money for the good of the nation, for all the nation, that literally cannot be touched by the globalists.
Is it necessary with this system to find a way to restrict the government from going overboard? Because I can imagine, say, if you give the government the potential to create money directly, then there's going to be a temptation to appease voters by funding all sorts of social programs.
You've hit the nail right on the head. That's the most intelligent question you could have asked. And I'd be the first one to say, I would not trust the government of today and the politicians we have with the power of the Bradbury and sovereign money. I wouldn't want it. No, there's got to be a package. Right. And the other part of the package is putting honourable people into positions of decision-making. And we want to, I call it a veritocracy, where literally you have a truth. You have that democracy that's driven by truth only, and wisdom and experience. And in many respects, we take a leaf out of the indigenous peoples, who, when, you know, when we have our old people, they're called elderly. And we put the elderly into homes. I'm rapidly approaching that now. My daughter will be deciding which home she puts me into. God help me. No, as far as I'm concerned, we knock the L-Y off elderly and call ourselves elders. And in the indigenous peoples, they have a huge amount of respect for their elders. And this is what we've got to start doing here. We need, in Saxon times and early and in early medieval, but Saxon times when they came about, you had the Witans. And this was an assembly of wise counselors to advise the king. Well, in a modern day democracy, you should have elected a Witan, people who are tried and tested for their integrity and for their wisdom. We want to get rid of career politicians. We need to get rid of political parties. We need to know that everybody who is there making decisions are doing it for the people, not for their own vested interests. And that means the lobbyists would be put into touch. In other words, we want a world that is driven by truth and integrity, not by advantage, political advantage, and personal ambition.
Can I just come in here, please?
Please do.
For myself, I see that the biggest asset that the Bradbury Pound as a story, as uncovering the history of it, and the potential of what a sovereign money solution could bring about. For me, its most useful aspect is really underlying what the debt-based money system brings about with these booms and busts, with the inflation, with employment issues, et cetera, et cetera, with all the wealth being siphoned off or largely, et cetera, into private hands and so on and so on. And how simple it would be to change that situation by saying, stuff you, Bank of England, we're just going to go it alone. But as Justin's clearly made out, we need either a regional authority or a central authority that's actually acting on behalf of the British people, and that is servants of the British people, and so on and so on. But for myself, I'd much rather actually come down to empowering individuals and empowering communities, so that we make our own decisions at the lowest level possible. And so it's all about decentralization, in my view. So I'm not a big fan of going down a sort of restored Bradbury Pound route, although I think it has interesting potential. So I'm not at all saying it's not worth exploring. But for myself, I wish to put my energies as an anarchist and of many years standing into those sort of decentralized possibilities. And I mean, the great thing about that is there's so much creativity in that area and so many interesting things that are popping to the surface at the moment. And also, although I don't understand cryptocurrencies, what I do understand is that there is a way of doing that which is completely decentralized and completely community driven, and I have my doubts about the sort of main cryptocurrencies we hear about, but there are some fantastic examples of very grassroots community driven projects really doing a huge amount of good work in that area. So what I brought in terms of my passion and my aspect of what I contributed to the book, it was very much focusing on those decentralized solutions and in the greater context about encouraging the creation at the local level of what gets called parallel societies, which is essentially moving off the mainstream systems as much as possible, including the mainstream financial system, and creating our own system or a basket of solutions that work for us and that fit our own particular individual situations locally. So I just wanted to say that at this stage.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I think it's a very interesting point. I was wondering where you would come at that from your kind of anarchist, decentralized perspective. Gentlemen, I think there's a lot for people to chew on. There's a lot for me to chew on. So I wonder if I could ask you to make anything that you think I've missed that's valuable to say, and then maybe we can move towards concluding by painting a bit of a picture of what the implementation of either something similar to the Bradbury or a movement away from the current system would mean for our own society and the wider world where you see poverty prevailing.
Good idea. I'm sorry, my dog has woken up and he's now decided he's going to have a fight because it's lunchtime. Could I just say, I agree totally with what Daniel just said about decentralization. And people need to look at something called colonial scrip, SCRIP, which was probably the real reason why the American War of Independence took place. And that was the American colonies were actually creating their own. So each colony was creating its own version, if you like, of the greenback dollar or the Bradbury pound. So as far as I'm concerned, the principle of sovereign money can be taken right down to the lowest practicable level. As I said to you before we started the program, one of my heroes in life is a gentleman called Leopold Kohr, K-O-H-R, who wrote a book called The Breakdown of Nations, and he was the one who inspired E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful. So I'm not precious about the government remaining as strong as it is today. As far as I'm concerned, decentralization and power to the lowest practical level is absolutely crucial.
Right, so there could be some sort of, let's say, competition between different groups. I don't literally mean competition, but pluralism, let's say, between different groups attempting different currency solutions. And then we actually get to see which one plays out the best and creates the most prosperity, etc.
Well, I think you need to have a degree of standardization because people do travel around this, that and the other.
Yeah.
But it's decision-making about how much you create and for what projects and things like that should be taken right down to the lowest practicable level.
Yes.
Okay.
The way I see things panning out is that firstly, everything is based on community, and everything starts from who, you know, who are your fellow beings in your local community that want to get together, that want to create a better world, and that are willing to kick off some projects and explore what may or may not work. That is going to be across the board. It's whether it's growing food locally and getting away from supermarkets as much as possible, through to creating local means of exchange. Now, the way I see things is that there's no one size fits all solution here. We can have a basket of solutions and ways forward. So if we want to trade with somebody around the other side of the world, for example, then maybe cryptocurrency is the way to go. If we want to trade with communities and towns beyond our immediate locality, then maybe we want to think about some sort of sovereign money situation. At the moment, I've just recently come across this interesting project that's going on called Goldback, which is essentially a money note, which is not a promissory note or anything like that, and it's got real value because it's a sort of laminated piece of gold leaf with a beautiful design on it, which is 1/1000th of a troy ounce of 24 karat gold. So it has real value. It's making gold, if you like, easily tradable. It's something you could put in your wallet. I mean, these sort of things are coming about. As I say, the creativity is really kicking off in big ways. So there's all of that, and there's many different ways that we could go about this. And we've got to find what feels right and what fits right in our locality. But I feel also, and my greatest passion within all of this, is actually let's go back at least within our close-knit community where we have personal relationships and, you know, we have trust and so on. Let's go back or try and go back or think about going back to a moneyless society, what's called a gift economy, which is not based on this quid pro quo. You know, I trade something with you and I get something back, whether it's a barter situation or it's a something that I can then trade and get other things from that's all. I'm not saying that's not necessary, but when it comes down to the really local level, I think getting away from that and back into a gift economy, which is based on a different basis, which is generosity and gratitude. So it's a sort of an indigenous model, if you like, where I'm feeling abundant because I've got lots of apples. I've got a big orchard. I've got lots of apples. You know, I've got a surplus. I give them away to people. They feel grateful as a result of that. It builds goodwill. It builds good feeling. It builds community. And then when somebody else has a glut of pears, they then share that and they'll give me some pears because, we have this beautiful relationship together. And we all look out for each other. And when somebody has difficult times, then everybody rallies round and helps them out and so on and so on. So that's the ultimate thing, at least on the lower level, a very local level. So I think there's no necessarily it's not straightforward, but it's about seeing what works. And essentially the main thing is not giving our power away to these people who are just living off our energy.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I found this highly informative. I came in, as I've said, like the least prepared ever for this, and I found it a highly informative and interesting discussion. So thank you for that. Any final comments from either of you, be very welcome. And then please tell people the name of the book and where they can get it from.
Go on, Daniel, your book.
You go first, Justin, because you need to
Well,
talk to the dog.
I'm just going to say at the moment, my main priority is making people aware of the Bradbury, the history of it, and the very fact that our change in our pockets is still created the same way. So when I see people in food banks and struggling to pay their energy bills, we all know it's a complete scam. Taxation is a complete scam. Direct taxation, that is. How can you justify direct taxation when the money can actually be created by the Treasury? So anyway, I better go because unfortunately we've got a dog now. It's determined to go, so I'm going to probably say bye-bye for now. But I'll hand over to Daniel because he obviously
Yep.
is in the book.
I would
But
never
my
keep a dog from its dinner, so I fully agree with that, Justin. Thank you very much for coming on, and I'll speak again. Thank you.
my pleasure, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Well, I appreciate this chance to have this chat, Richard. Thank you. And yes, so the book is called The Truth of How Money is Created and the Financial System. And then I do love my long strap lines. The strap line is how a small number of people siphon off the vast majority of the world's wealth for themselves. And then this last bit is the most important bit, and how to change this. So all of my books are about, well, this is the problem, this is the conditioning that we've been, the indoctrination and how we're being, conned, etc. But we want to get away from that, and that's all of solutions based. It's about empowerment, as I've been saying. So that's what the book does in the context of the financial system. And it's great that I teamed up with Justin on this. To bring in his expertise and to bring in the Bradbury Pound and to tie it in also with decentralized solutions and so on, and the idea of creating parallel societies. So, I've got some lovely quotes on the front cover of the book, one of which is attributed to Jimi Hendrix, at least, but I've heard it a number of times, and it's and this kind of sums it up in some ways. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. And it's as simple as that, really. When we align ourselves with that, then we can create magnificent things and create a better world. So, where can you get a hold of a copy? Well, you certainly can't get a hold of a copy of this book and my other books from Amazon because I'm into decentralized solutions, as you know, and not si having money siphoned off to folk like that. So it's directly from me, and my website where you can get hold of them is called Dandelion Speaks. Dandelion as in the plant, Dandelion Speaks dot msvr dot uk. So that's Dandelion Speaks dot msvr dot uk.
And I shall link to that in the little info box beneath whatever platform people are listening to this on. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Much appreciate it, Richard. Thank you.